Welcome to the Relatable Finance Podcast. Here are your hosts, Joseph Carl and Shane Phillips.
So welcome to today's episode of Relatable Finance. If 2020 wasn't already crazy enough, believe it or not, we have an election coming up in about 4 months. As this is being recorded, things are changing rapidly. So we thought we would go over some things to consider as Election Day approaches. Before we get started, we want to say two things. We present this material in an objective, apolitical manner, which can be challenging in today's polarized world, but rest assured, we are not trying to sway you one way or another. While we may have our own political beliefs, our job every day is to review political implications on the economy and markets, and to do that effectively, we have to view the results and possibilities through an objective lens. Second, we want to remind everyone to go out and vote. It's a privilege and it really matters, so please go out and do so.
So before we get into some specifics, let's go over some statistics regarding market returns and elections. So we discussed a lot of this back in episode 34, specific to how elections affect investment markets and the economy, but just a handful here that are the most important. So number one, we are clearly in an election year, and election years historically have been the second best performer in the four-year election cycle. So if we go all the way back to 1900 and we look at election years, we've averaged about 10% a year for stock market returns. Next is if we look at the last 28 elections since the Great Depression, 25 of those 28 election years have had positive returns, which is great. Ironically, two of those three that we had negative years were relatively recently. We had the dot-com bubble back in 2000, and then we had the financial crisis back in 2008. Historically speaking, a president who's a Democrat, we've had markets slightly outperform when we've had a Republican president in office. This is something that people have many different opinions on, how you calculate this, and we totally agree that maybe it doesn't make sense in every case, but different people look at election day versus inauguration day, and some people even look at it a year or two after those days to really start the clock. So a lot of different opinions there. And then lastly, something we'll talk about more later is when we look at Congress. So historically, a split Congress has been best for the investment markets. We've seen about 17% a year investment stock market return since 1950 for a split Congress. A Republican Congress has been about 13% a year, and then a Democratic Congress at about 11% a year.
Next up, the economy has a major impact on the election result. The stronger the economy, the stronger an incumbent president is to be reelected. To provide some additional context, Moody's, a credit rating and financial service software provider, issued a 2020 election model, which is actually comprised of many different smaller models. The model's taken into consideration a wide variety of variables from a political and economic perspective and backtest them with data from previous elections. For the models to be accurate, the political factors have to be taken into consideration, but what drives the all-important marginal voter is economics. At the moment, there are many uncertainties from an economic perspective, but if we assume for a moment that the coronavirus did not come, one could argue that the economy would likely be very strong. As such, what happens in the next 4 months will likely have a major impact on the election outcome.
So when we look at the presidential election, at this point, there's really just two candidates. We have President Trump, and then we have Joe Biden. And there's going to be lots and lots of differences between the two, but we're going to break it down to really three different ones when we look at it from an economic and investment perspective. And those three main ones are going to be taxes, how each of them views continued stimulus measures to really support us in recovering from the coronavirus. And then lastly, how they go about dealing with China. So first, let's look at taxes. Joe Biden has proposed an increase in taxes. Let's just call it overall increase in taxes. It's likely if he were elected, he would repeal much of the changes President Trump passed back in 2017 in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. What that would likely mean is an increase in corporate tax rates up to about 28%. And we'd also be likely to see an increase in the marginal tax rate as well.
Well, that may be Biden's intention. One could argue that we're going to need to increase taxes at some point to help offset all of the stimulus measures that we've enacted to help boost the economy from the coronavirus. That may be difficult to do initially. Higher taxes would certainly slow economic growth, at least initially, at a time when we actually want to encourage the economy to grow as quickly as possible. As such, while those tax changes, if Biden is elected, may eventually occur, probably going to be delayed somewhat. Lastly, tensions have been rising with China. And given that the U.S. and China are the two world's largest economies, this has dramatic implications throughout the global economy. If Trump is elected, one could argue that he takes a more aggressive approach as he no longer has to worry about re-election. Conversely, Biden would need to try and be re-elected, or one would assume that he would want to, and he may take a more casual or less aggressive approach with China. The idea here is that this is a fine line. China is certainly viewing things through their lens and want to continue to grow as aggressively as possible. So whether we have a very mutual outcome would be challenging.
So let's fast forward to later this year. We have an election in November, and the million-dollar question is, who's going to win the election? So based upon where we're currently at, what we can do is look at polling. So under current polls, and this is an average, so not all polls, but when we look at it currently, Joe Biden appears to have a slight lead in the presidential race. Democrats appear to also have a slight lead for the Senate. And then Democrats look to have a little bit larger lead when it comes to the House race. We will get into these a little bit more later, but again, these are just polls, and polls may have some faults to them.
Yeah, so how does current polling compare to what we saw ahead of the 2016 election? Through June of 2016, there are a total of 44 polls conducted, with Democrats having an on average a lead of 5.7 points. And leading in 84% of those polls. Through June of this year, so through the same exact time frame, 72 polls have been conducted. Democrats lead by an average of 5.9 points and are leading in 94% of those polls. It is worth noting that the margin between these two typically tends to narrow as we get closer to the election. And as we all know, the polls were not accurate in 2016 with Trump winning the presidency.
So another case where the polling wasn't correct was again back in 2016, and a pretty big decision over in the UK, and that was regarding what's now known as Brexit. So I remember Brexit very, very well for a couple of reasons. First, during the actual vote, I was flying, and the minute I landed and got cell phone reception, I had a whole bunch of updates from Joe flood my phone, with it basically saying that it looks like they were going to exit. And secondly, the reason that was so surprising is everything that we had seen leading up to it had the polls saying that they would remain. So Brexit ultimately won by more than a million votes, about 52% to 48%. And a couple of the reasons why they think maybe the polling didn't come in as accurate as the actual vote was voter turnout. And specifically young voters did not turn out in the amount that they thought. These younger voters were a big part of the Remain campaign. So that may be one of them. And another one that they kind of pinpointed is the different types of polls. So they had online polls and then telephone polls, and the polling was different based upon which route you had.
So what led to poor polling predictions in the prior election, and is that a possibility this time around? Part of the reason the polls were off or incorrect in the prior election is that they made an assumption that voter turnout would be similar to prior elections, when in reality that wasn't the case. If you look at the overall turnout of the voting age population in 2016, it was really close to what it was in 2012 at 61.4% versus 61.8%, so a very small change. But what was different is there was significant shifts in demographics, and as we all know, that those demographic shifts certainly favored Trump. There's also statistical evidence that suggests that there's voter fatigue. So another way, if one party has held office for 8 years, voters are less likely to vote for that party again, which means voter turnout could be different, or some could switch sides. Historically, fatigue is not a factor for a one-term president, so that shouldn't be an issue with this election. Another factor contributing to the poor polling results in 2016 is the presence of minor party candidates Gary Johnson and Jill Stein. Remember them? Over 5.9 people voted for them, and there was actually a lot more supporters than that, but many switched last minute, realizing that they weren't likely to win. Data suggests that a lot of those votes went to Donald Trump. Finally, the lack of minor party candidates suggests that this is not a possibility this time. Lastly, polls now better account for demographics and technology. How polls were done before suggested that Clinton had a large lead, when in reality that wasn't the case. Adjustments have been made to try and better capture the respective demographics of the respective areas.
So obviously polling has its faults, but when we look ahead to the actual election for president, there's really a handful of key battleground states. And when we look at these, and there's six, and I'm including Wisconsin as the sixth because my home state, but combined, we have about 100 electoral college votes between these. So Just running through them, the biggest is Florida, which obviously we're very familiar with. Florida is always a battleground state. Trump won by about 1.2% back in 2016. But again, it looks like it's up for grabs. Pennsylvania has 20 electoral college votes, which Trump slightly won back in 2016 as well. Joe's home state of Ohio has 18 votes, was won pretty easily by Trump back in 2016, but is likely going to be closer this time around. We have North Carolina with 15 votes, Arizona with 11, and then lastly, Wisconsin with 10 votes. So Wisconsin, to go a little bit deeper, Trump won by less than 23,000 votes back in 2016. And back to the polling, or the fault of the polling, the polls leading up to the 2016 vote in Wisconsin, none of them had Trump leading. On average, those polls had Clinton winning by an average of 6%. So just shows you that these states are probably very much up for grabs, and the polling may not be totally correct for some of the reasons Joe just went over.
Shane just threw out some numbers on battleground states and the number of electoral college votes that each state represents. Each state has a number of electoral votes, which is determined by the census, essentially population. Each state has the right to choose how to allocate their electoral college votes. All but Maine and Nebraska use a popular winner-take-all approach. This is why states with larger number of electoral college votes and have had historically close election results are called battleground states. Very small shifts in voting can entirely flip a state, and given how the electoral college is set up, that can have dramatic implications. As Shane just mentioned, Trump won Florida, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin by extraordinarily slim margins, less than 1.2%. Had, for example, Clinton won those, the election result would have been different. This is why it can be difficult to gauge things. Just a simple national approval rating or other readings, while informative from an overall country perspective, have less predictive power when it comes to the election.
So if we look at the races, again, for the Senate and the House, I mentioned earlier how a split between the two has historically been better for the markets, but we'll see how it plays out this time. So looking at the House, there are 435 seats, all of which are up for grabs. As it currently stands, it's a Democratic House with about 235 Democrats, 199 Republicans, and one Libertarian. The Democrats took majority back in 2018, largely by winning districts that Trump had won during the presidential election back in 2016. So that will be a key focus for Republicans, is to win back some of those districts. Again, when we talk about battleground states, I mean, we're really looking at battleground districts when it comes to the House, but there really are probably anywhere from about 20 to 25 elections that are really toss-ups, and again, are likely to sway how the House looks later on this year. The Senate, on the other hand, is not all up for election. There are 100 total seats, 35 of which are up for grabs. Currently, it is Republican-controlled at 53 Republicans. The seats that are not up for grabs would be currently standing 35 Democrats and 30 Republicans. So definitely a very important 35 seats. And the Republicans have held control of the Senate for some time now. They won it back in 2014 and then retained it back in 2016 and 2018.
Lastly, what may be different for this election here in 2020? Well, as we all know, the coronavirus is going on and there are associated health risks. So there's probably going to be some social distancing measures, and we would expect in-person voting to decrease significantly. Actually, in-person voting has been decreasing for a while, declining from 90% in 1996 to 60% in 2016. It's certain that this will decline significantly this time around. Of particular interest is the vote by mail. In the prior elections, 23% of all votes were by mail or absentee. All states allowed some sort of vote by mail prior to the coronavirus, but also prior to the virus, 16 required a reason, such as planned travel or disability. Since the onset of the pandemic, 5 have waived those limitations. Even if vote by mail is allowed, there are rules that need to be followed. You can't just vote by mail and show up. One person can vote 2 times. So, in Florida, for example, you need to let them know that you intend to vote by mail at least 10 days ahead of the election, and your vote needs to be received by mail by 7 p.m. on the day of the election. This creates some challenges that could be a major factor. As we get closer and closer to the election, things are likely to evolve, so those things are probably going to change, but nonetheless, that's a factor to consider in determining the outcome of the election. Just to wrap things up, the economy is a major factor in determining who will win the nomination. The economy was strong to start the year, but as we all know, the presence of the coronavirus has a major impact. So the next couple of months will have a major impact on the outcome of the election. Polling suggests currently that Biden has a lead, but 2016 showed that polling did not predict the results that well. If you want to try and predict the outcome of the election, you need to try and pay close attention to the races in states with high electoral college votes and tight races. Minor changes in these areas can have big implications given how their electoral college is set up. And finally, voter turnout is a major factor in determining the outcome of the election. And with the presence of the coronavirus, it may be hard to predict as many will likely vote by mail, and each state has its own rules regarding vote by mail. We hope you enjoy this episode of Relatable Finance. Please don't hesitate to reach out to us at any time with questions at relatablefinance@provwealth.com or follow us at Twitter @financepodcast.
Provenance Wealth Advisors is not a registered broker-dealer and is independent of Raymond James Financial Services, Inc. Securities are offered through Raymond James Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Investment advisory services are offered through Provenance Wealth Advisors and Raymond James Financial Services Advisors, Inc. Any opinions are those of Relatable Finance Podcast and PWA, and not necessarily those of Raymond James. The information contained in this report does not purport to be a complete description of the securities, markets, or developments referred to in this material. There is no assurance that any of the trends mentioned will continue or forecasts will occur. The information has been obtained from sources considered to be reliable, but Raymond James does not guarantee that the foregoing material is accurate or complete. Any information is not a complete summary or statement of all available data necessary for making an investment decision. It does not constitute a recommendation. Investment involves risk, and you may incur a profit or loss regardless of strategy selected. Diversification and asset allocation do not ensure a profit or protect against a loss. Investing involves risk, and investors may incur a profit or loss. Raymond James does not provide tax or legal services. Please discuss these matters with the appropriate professional. Past performance does not guarantee future results. Future investment performance cannot be guaranteed, and investment yields will fluctuate with market conditions. Any examples given in the podcast are for illustration purposes only. Actual investor results will vary.